Hi, I'm Ken Kessler, and welcome to the Sounds of Christmas podcast. If you're new to this podcast, I want to start by saying thanks for joining us. If you're not new, welcome back. Either way, I'm glad you're here. Now, to avoid any confusion, I want to start off by saying there won't be any music played here. This is a place for conversation. I'll talk about Christmas music and some related topics, sometimes by myself and sometimes with guests. If you're looking for music, just go to soundsofchristmas.com and click on the tree or the player on the front page or on the Listen Now page. We play the best variety of Christmas music all year long. Well, except in October, when we play the best variety of Halloween music. Folk New Age guitarist Bob Sorois is with us for this episode of the Sounds of Christmas podcast. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Ken. How are you today?
So far, so good. And you?
Oh, we're taking the right step forward. Things are good.
And now, is that the right way that you like to be introduced as a folk New Age guitarist?
Yeah, I mean, that definitely works. Folk New Age, I guess that's sort of my defined, direction in terms of style and genre. But yeah, absolutely. That works great. I mean, as opposed to saying, you know, that Christmas music is the only thing I do, it's not. I do other things as well. But as far as my style, yeah, absolutely. That works perfectly.
Okay. Because I know you got your start as a rock guitarist in a band called Under the Rose. But John Denver and his music sort of led you in a different direction, right?
Yeah, that's what happened. I mean, if we kind of scroll back to the 80s, you know, during my teenage years, rock, you know, the rock 80s thing, the hard rock metal stuff was definitely big. I was into that. And that's what the band I was in did. And even in the 90s, the band I was in, we did I wouldn't say it was heavy metal, but it was definitely more of a rock-oriented thing. But about 1996 or so, I was kind of reintroduced to John Denver. I mean, I really hadn't heard his music since I had been a kid because my parents listened to it around the house all the time. And as I recall, the story is that my parents were looking for a new CD player and a new component system. I helped them pick it out, and they wanted some CDs. So one of the CDs that they ended up buying was John Denver's Greatest Hits. So, of course, I'm hearing that, and I'm thinking, hey, there's some really cool tunes here. This guy was great. And so at that point, I just said, hey, I really need to get into this. I need to start learning how to play this kind of stuff. Turns out I had to take a huge step back to do that. It's a whole different way of playing. And I did. And then over a period of years, I redefined my entire direction, and that's what I became. And yeah, so kind of a game changer, I guess.
You know, for anybody listening who wasn't there, John Denver's Greatest Hits was probably one of the, I don't have the stats in front of me, but it was probably one of the biggest selling albums of the 70s. He was huge. He had tons of hits. He was on TV often, right, with his own specials.
Yep.
Guesting on other people's specials. He was everywhere, and winning awards. I mean, he was huge in the 70s, and it's just amazing. Oh, yeah. You can't really talk about music from the 70s with not mentioning John Denver.
No, not really. And I agree with you. I mean, he clearly became a superstar at the time. And in fact, I recall that they used to compare his rise to fame to, you know, I guess artists like Elvis and even the Beatles. I mean, to a degree, although you really can't compare too many people to the Beatles. But right. John Denver, he was the thing at the time. And his music, it was different, you know. I mean, he came out, I think, at the right time with that right music. I think if you had an artist come along today with his talent doing the same kind of thing, I don't think it would stick. I just think that time period coming out of the folk movement in the, you know, late 60s, coming into the 70s, you had all these great folk players going on, like James Taylor and Jim Croce. And then you had, you know, Simon and Garfunkel going on. And you had some really cool, eclectic type of types of styles and genres that were acceptable at the time. And John Denver kind of, I think he just sort of, you know, came right into that period. It worked for him, and he just became huge. And you know, you mentioned stats. His Greatest Hits album, I believe, if memory serves, because I'm published by the same publisher as John Denver, with Cherry Lane Music's RCA. So I kind of have information on that stuff I've gathered over the years. And basically, his Greatest Hits album, I believe, was a bigger seller than any Elvis album that had ever been released. Wow. So, yeah, and this was back in the 70s. I'm sure by today's standards, I have no idea what those numbers are, but they're huge.
Right. Well, and another thing about John Denver was that, I mean, I never got to meet him.
No, I didn't either, no.
Appearances are that he was he was a good guy. He wasn't plagued by scandals. He wasn't, he didn't seem to be egotistical or anything by his really sudden success and fame. He did a live album in the Albert Hall in England.
Right. And, okay. I think I know the one you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And you can hear, you can just tell in his voice at one point he is just awestruck, but that he's there.
Yeah.
He
yeah.
does something that's, like that. Wow. I can't believe I'm here doing this. And that all of you guys showed up.
Yeah.
So
cool.
he was just a really good guy.
He was. And that's the thing. I think he appreciated what he had and what he, you know, did. And, you know, he knew even with talent, you know, you can have a lot of talent and but still not get there. There's so many different, the planets have to align themselves the right way. I mean, you have to have some luck on your side. You got to meet the right people at the right time. There's so many dynamics and so many different variables. And I think he appreciated it. I think one thing he used to say is he used to say that this gift I have doesn't come from me, is how he put it. It comes from, you know, he wouldn't say God per se, but he would definitely suggest a divine influence of some sort there, that it's not his gift. It was given to him. And which I always appreciated that, because I thought, you know, in a world where not everybody, but a lot of artists do tend to become a little bit egocentric over time, you know, he didn't go there, and he never did, even at the height of his success. And yeah, he was a good guy. And his family is the same way, actually. I had a chance to meet his family, his mom before she passed away. I met her. I met his brother. I played with his band members on several shows out in Aspen many years ago. So, I mean, they were the same way. They were just genuine, good-hearted people, loved to play, great at what they did, phenomenal musicians. But there was never this feeling of, for me anyway, because coming into that, it was like, oh, my God, I'm playing with these guys that are obviously, you know, I mean, let's face reality, some of the best of the best. And but I never had this feeling of feeling like I was less or feeling as though I was being, you know, looked at as though, OK, well, who is this newcomer? They just welcomed me in. It was great. It was like we had played together for 10 years. It was pretty cool. So the whole package was like that, I believe.
Yeah. And I promise this whole thing isn't going to be about John Denver, but
no, not at all.
You know, he also, while he became hugely famous and successful.
Yeah.
He didn't take himself too seriously. He did that special and the album with the Muppets, the Christmas one.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, and it looked like he was having a great time. And it's still so popular.
It is. It is crazy enough. And the funny thing is, I mean, in addition to doing what I do, you know, with the records that I release and you know, everything that's involved with that. I mean, I also teach music in the school system as well. I've gotten involved with that in recent years. And a lot of kids, I mean, even young kids, we're talking kids that are fourth grade, third grade sometimes, they're aware of his existence. They know of his songs. I mean, if I start singing Country Roads, like, oh, I love that song. Mom and Dad are listening to that. They know the Muppets programs and the albums because their parents have it. So they're being introduced to these things by their parents because that stuff is still there. It's really an awesome thing when you think about it, because I don't think there are too many artists that have that kind of staying power. In his case, he just had something that just people could attach themselves to. It was meaningful, you know, and it was I think it took people away from the everyday, and it brought you to a place that was peaceful. You know, you kind of the implications of nature and, you know, just the Rocky Mountains where he loved, you know, to live, and all of that kind of got factored in. And I think people loved it, and they still do. So it's pretty awesome.
It really is. And this was not a phenomenon that was just exclusive to the United States or that it remained here in the U.S. A few weeks ago, I was talking to Grant Malloy Smith, who has a new Christmas album out. And he was touring, and I can't remember the country. I think it was in Europe. And it was somewhere that English was not the primary language there.
Sure.
And the promoter or the venue asked him if he knew any John Denver songs because it was so popular.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really He didn't play a lot of cover songs, but he agreed to, and he closed the show out. I think it was with Country Road, and every person in this packed auditorium was on their feet singing along to the point that he had to play it again because they wouldn't stop.
Yeah, it's that is really what it is. It's strange. I mean, you can't we can't say that about every one of his songs, but that song in and of itself, he probably didn't even couldn't have realized at the time when it became as famous as it did in, I don't know, 1973 or so. I forget what it was, but how powerful that song was going to be. And today, as I mentioned, I'll retract back to the whole school thing. You know, I've been singing that song in concerts for the kids. We do concerts for the kids at school in Christmas time and also springtime. And for the spring concerts, more often than not, I mean, I'll include that song almost every single year because the kids love it so much. Everybody loves it. They always do a great job with it. Everybody knows it. So no matter where you go, no matter where I go, that song is just known. It's just an automatic. It's, you don't even have to wonder, hey, you know, are the kids going to latch onto this? Because they're going to know it. And half the time, they don't even need the lyrical content in front of them. They just kind of start singing. So it's pretty awesome. And then when that happens, I kind of think to myself, wherever he is now, I wonder if he can see this kind of stuff. And I wonder to myself, gosh, you know, I it'd be nice if he knew just how much his music is actually transitioned itself into the future. It's incredible, in my opinion.
Yeah, it really is. And I'm going to try and get off the John Denver track right now because I know it's going to come back up in a little bit. But I want to get back to talking about you and your journey. And I know John Denver and his music were part of that. Mm. But you left this rock band and you went solo and you signed a 4-album deal with Sony. How did that happen?
Actually, the 4-album deal wasn't with Sony directly. It's always hard to describe. And the real reason is because there are so many fingers in the pot. Every company is co-owned by this company, mergers here, left and right. You got subdivisions of this, that, and everything else. It's very corporate. But what happened was this. So I actually officially left the band in 2003. So it was really several years after I started kind of getting into the whole John Denver thing, the folk thing, classical music, and going down that separate path. And that actually got infused into the band a little bit too toward the end, which was interesting. But I left the band in 2003, really not because there was a problem in the band, really just because we were getting older. We had families starting to have kids, you know, we're all married. And honestly, doing the whole gig thing on the weekend was getting to be too much. I was tired. They were tired and we're all good friends. And so I left. And basically what I decided to do is I thought, well, I've got my solo thing going on here. I put out my first Christmas record and I really want to focus on that. So what happened was about 2 years, I guess, before I left the band, Under the Rose was the band that I was in. We had signed a publishing deal with Cherry Lane Music. Now, Cherry Lane Music is John Denver's publisher and a whole bunch of other people that are fairly famous as well. So we signed this publishing deal and finally get off the ground. And attached to that, it was a company called Attack Music Group. So they were like a record company, an independent record label. So Sony's affiliation there is more on the publishing end. And then RCA Records was a piece of it as well. So what happened was once I left, they knew I was doing a Christmas record at the Attack Records company. And they came to me, they said, you know, they said, we don't have a Christmas catalog. And they said, we have everything else, but we don't have a Christmas catalog. They said, you know, would you be interested in creating over time a catalog of Christmas music that we can utilize for publishing purposes or release whatever we need it for in terms of media content? And I said, you know, I said, that sounds interesting. I said, I love Christmas music. I said, I'm a huge fan of Christmas. And I said, you know, yeah, let's do it. So we ended up putting together, it was actually a 3-album deal at first. It got extended to a 4th album down the road. But the idea was the first one came out in 2002, Hometown Christmas, Dreams of Christmas, 2005, trying to think here. 2008 was A Christmas Melody. And then 2009 was the Rocky Mountain Christmas tribute to John Denver's Rocky Mountain Christmas from 1975. So that's kind of where it came from. So really it came out of sort of the affiliation with the band, because that's where we ended up meeting these people and these individuals in these different organizations. And thankfully it carried over for me afterward on a solo basis. And yeah, so from there, basically between 2002 and 2009, 2010, those records came out and it was a fun time. It was exciting. Everything got released into the marketplace. So that's kind of how it happened, strangely enough.
Yeah, it's, I hate to say unusual because that makes it sound kind of weird, but it is unusual that somebody not only would be signed to that kind of a record deal, but to a Christmas to what's really a Christmas album deal.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. It was exclusively a Christmas album deal. The cool thing was I was still able to interject my own original material. So, you know, they didn't mind me putting two or three or whatever songs on there, their originals, as long as we had enough of the staples, you know, the traditional Christmas classics, things like that. They kind of gave me a lot of freedom, actually, to do what I wanted to do, as long as it fit within a certain, you know, certain parameters. And so I did. And it was a lot of fun, and they were really they were great to work with when I was going through the, you know, the process of recording. I was able to do it on my own, you know, with in studios I wanted to utilize. I was able to hire, you know, musicians that I needed. So if there was someone that I an instrument I didn't play, I was able to kind of designate who that person was going to be, which makes it better because, you know, it's great when the record company gets involved, but sometimes there are certain areas you don't want them to get involved.
Right.
And that's one of the areas. So they were great. And this would have never happened if this had been a major label, because major labels, they all have content, you know, in every category they need. This being an independent record company, they had only been around for maybe, at that point, I don't know, maybe 5-6 years. So they were new, you know, and they were new to the marketplace. They were new to just the business in general. And so the fact that they were new basically meant that they did not have a Christmas catalog. And timing, again, I come back to the timing thing. We talked about John Denver with timing back in the 60s and 70s. It, for me, that was timing. I mean, because at that point, I was like 34, 35 years old. Typically, you're not signing record deals at 35 years old.
Certainly not your first one. Yeah.
No, not at all. So I was lucky. I counted myself as very lucky. I was fortunate. I was excited. It was fun. I had a great time with it. And all of those experiences have set me up for a whole lot of other experiences that I've had after that point that would not have happened had it not been for that.
So the first one, the first Christmas album was A Hometown Christmas. And that was one that you had put together before this deal actually happened, right?
Yeah, I did. Really what that was me just sort of stretching myself out to do something different, you know, just on my own as a solo artist. It was multi-pronged in the sense that the album itself, yeah, I wanted to do a Christmas album, but I also wanted to do a solo album, whatever that might be. And I had never done anything like that before. It had always been myself and the band members I was with, because we had done three of our own albums back in the 90s. And so I thought, this would be an interesting endeavor to try to do this on my own and, see how it comes out and then really try to accomplish something new that I've never done before. So that was really the initial inspiration. And then the Christmas piece of it, I think it was Christmas time 2001 is when I made that choice. And I remember just jumping behind the guitar and starting to grab some of my favorite Christmas classics and starting to create guitar versions of them during that time. And then I said, you know, I'm doing this. And that was it. And then I released it a year later, Christmas 2002. And then it was really the next year after that when Attack Records came to me once they got wind of this whole thing and said, hey, you know, let's do a Christmas album deal if you're interested. Yeah. So it's interesting to think back. When you ask the question, that's when I start remembering some of this stuff.
Well, and then a couple years later came Dreams of Christmas. Mm-hmm. And that was followed up a year later by a DVD of Dreams of Christmas. Was that your idea or the record label's idea?
No, that was the label. They had content that they, I guess, was, I don't know if it was sitting there or I'm not even sure where the content came from, frankly, but they wanted to release a DVD of Christmas videos, basically. So, you know, try to think of like a nostalgic kind of, you know, the kind of thing you'd put on your TV if you've got people over Christmas Eve, whatever, and you keep it kind of lightly in the background. That's what they were looking to release. And that's when they asked me, you know, they said, you know, we'd like to put some of your music on there from your first two records, which is Hometown Christmas and Dreams of Christmas. And I said, that's fine. No problem. I mean, I had no issue with that at all. So then they picked certain songs. They put them on there. And the nice thing is there was sort of a cross promotional piece of that that helped me, you know, because, again, they were using this DVD to promote two albums they're already promoting. So it was kind of a different level of advertising, I guess. And so the whole thing worked out really, really well.
And then A Christmas Melody.
Yeah, that's the 2008 one, right?
Yeah. And A Christmas Melody, that's the one that came out. I think that's where we first connected. The Sounds of Christmas had only been around for a short while.
Okay.
And and I saw this new album. It was by a name I didn't know, but but I was all about getting, you know, trying to promote new Christmas music, because part of the reason that I did the Sounds of Christmas was that there's so much new music every year and nobody hears about it, but a lot of people like to complain that there's no new Christmas music, but it's really and this is the part of almost every podcast where I jump on traditional radio, because they want to stay safe. Yes. And they play the hits and they play the same short list of songs every year.
They do. And, yes.
But I found this and it's a beautiful winter picture on the cover. And I gave it a listen and the first track had me. It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Oh, wow.
Shirley Bonnell sings that one. She's sung some songs on previous stuff. But that one came on and I was like, This is great. This is a song people would like. She sings Old Toy Trains on that too.
Yeah, she does.
One of my favorites.
That's a great tune. It really is.
And I think Old Toy Trains is a great song, and it doesn't, for whatever reason, doesn't get covered that much anymore.
No, it doesn't. Actually, there aren't too many cover versions out there. But it is an awesome song. And interestingly enough, the first time I actually heard that song was when I was in the process of recording Dreams of Christmas. I had never even heard the song before. And I think it was done in the 1950s or something, a long time ago. I don't know if it was Roger Miller or I forget who it was, but during the tracking of Dreams of Christmas, the guy that owned the studio that I used at the time that I worked with, he was also a very close friend because he recorded the records for Under the Rose prior. So I had worked with him quite a bit over the years. And, so his studio was basically, in his house. I mean, I don't want to say it's in his house, but it's attached to his house. And so we'd go there. Of course, his kids would come running in and out every once in a while. And, the family kind of thing is going on. And so one day his kids come running in. They were young at the time and they wanted to hear this song called Old Toy Trains. So we stopped for a minute. We're kind of taking a break and he puts this song on and he looks at me. He says, oh, he said, you should do this song. He said, this is a great song. And I thought, gosh, I've never heard this song. So I heard it. I listened to it. I said, this is really a really nice song. I couldn't believe I had never heard it before. So that record, Dreams of Christmas, was already pretty much done. I really couldn't add any tracks to it. So then I made the choice after that point to add it to A Christmas Melody. And to me, the original version uses the word boy, only boy, 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 all the way through. And I thought, I want to have a woman sing it, first of all, which would be different because I really hadn't heard any versions with a female singer. And I said, I also want to change it up so that you have, boy, and you also have girl. That way it covers all the bases. So, and that's one of the songs I think that has probably been paid the closest attention to over the years from that record, just because it resonates for everybody.
Old Toy Trains, first by Roger Miller, 1966-67.
Oh, was it 60s? Okay.
And Glenn Campbell did it the next year.
Oh, he did. Interesting.
And
okay.
Then it the Statler Brothers did it years later. Toby Keith did it about 20 years ago.
Okay.
And I think Nick Lowe did it like 10 years ago.
Lowe, wow, there's that. That's interesting. Yeah. Okay.
But otherwise, and those aren't the only versions. But there just aren't a lot. And I don't know if it's. I just think it's a really neat, wonderful song.
It is. It is.
And it's so that one. Between that and the first track, that really won me over, and I had to reach out to you.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. That's good to know. I'm happy it worked out that way.
Yeah, I remember reaching out to you, and I hadn't heard of you before, but I found this album, and I really liked what I heard, and I got you to record some things and do an interview, and you sent.
Yeah, I remember that. Yes,
I didn't even realize that you had two previous Christmas albums. You sent those to me, so I got all your music on the station, which was really terrific. And then you turned around and you did the tribute for John Denver.
Yeah.
The Rocky Mountain Christmas. It was like a year or two later, right?
Yeah, it was a year later. I did it. I released it, I'm sorry, in 2009. So literally a year later. And what happened was this. there's a story to this, obviously. So, sure. I mean, Rocky Mountain Christmas is not only my all-time favorite Christmas album, it's my all-time favorite album with my all-time favorite song, which is Aspenglow. So, and for so many different reasons. I mean, it's just a record that for whatever reason for me, it was everything, you know, and every Christmas, not even just every Christmas, sometimes middle of the year, I'd listen to it. And I still do today, frankly. What happened was I wanted to do a more or less an instrumental version. I say instrumental, not entirely instrumental, but mostly instrumental version of his record. And I already had some of the songs recorded on the prior records from that album. So it was really just I didn't need like another 2 years or 2.5 years to record like I would normally need. All I really needed to do was take certain select tracks that needed to be how I thought about it at the time, improved upon, and kind of brought to a place that made sense for this album. So I did that, like Aspenglow, and then also Baby Just Like You. I hired a different female vocalist who came in and sang that. I redid some of the tracks, mainly because if you listen to Rocky Mountain Christmas, one thing you may notice is that there's a certain delicate like nature to that album. The guitars, the, you know, just everything sounds sort of soft, and acoustic guitars tend to be very percussive and very grainy. You know, they kind of hit. It's a percussive instrument, so you can liken it to the sounds of drums and percussion, things like that. So for them to produce at the time with acoustic guitars that soft sound, I was really blown away by that, and I thought I really need to try to reproduce that as much as possible, because that sound that they created is a big piece of why that record sounds so amazing and why it's so different. And so that's what I did. I went back and I redid some things, took out certain tracks, put in other tracks, and tried to create that sound as much as I could. And so really the amount of work I had to put in was, you know, maybe 20% of what you normally have to put into a record. And that's why I was able to kick it out 1 year later.
And you mentioned a new female singer, Rachel Taylor, who sings also Christmas Like a Lullaby, which is just so pretty.
Yeah, that song is great. I know. That song, you know, I like that. I like the entire record, both, you know, obviously Christmas Melody and Rocky Mountain Christmas Tribute. I would have to say that probably is one of my favorites on both. And not because it's my favorite song by John Denver, but because I felt that song really found the place I wanted it to go, and then some. It just worked. Everything came together. The entire recording to me was just really advanced, and it just, the connection was fantastic. And so when I listen back to that, I'm proud of that, you know, of that piece of it. And so but Rachel Taylor, she's an incredible vocalist. Very, you know, if you listen to her compared to Shirley, there's a vastly different performance style and sound. But another great vocalist. Again, I've been kind of lucky to find some of the right people over the years, that without them I would not have been able to have done what I've done.
And the thing that really struck me about this album, Rocky Mountain Christmas, is that there are some Christmas albums that they're the center of attention. You put them on and you can't do something else. You really want to.
Yeah.
You're involved in it. And there are some that you put on and they're nice. They're background. Yeah. You can have your Christmas party or do whatever you're decorating and stuff. And it's on in the background. You don't have to really pay attention.
Right.
Rocky Mountain Christmas is really neither of those. The word that I want to use is fragile, but I don't want to use that in a bad way. It's like you have to pay attention to it, because there's just this feeling that if you don't, you're going to miss something.
Yeah, it is easy to miss something in there. And that comes back to you. For me, fragile is a good word to use, because that kind of sort of corresponds with the delicate word that I utilized before. It really is. There's a fragility to it, not in terms of performance, but in terms of sonic sound and where things are placed. For me, I'm a huge proponent of, I love especially certain, you know, music, certain songs. I like to listen in with really good high quality headphones. And the reason why is because you have this stereo kind of spectrum around you, you know, that some artists utilize more than others. And back in that, at that time, they did that. John Denver's producer was Milt Oken, and also a studio engineer at the time as well. And he just really knew how to place the instruments. So if you listen in, if you listen on a stereo system, you're hearing everything, but you're not getting the stereo imagery that you would normally get with headphones. That's where you're suddenly realizing, holy cow, okay, that guitar is way over to the left side. I didn't realize that. Oh, okay, that chime is way over there. It just, you're kind of surrounded, but everything's placed in there so delicately that it's almost as though all the instruments are one instrument, but they're separate at the same time. And it's not an easy thing to accomplish in a recording studio.
And if you're not familiar with some of Bob's work, I encourage you to go look up this album, Bob Saroy's Rocky Mountain Christmas. Look it up on whatever streaming service you use and play it. And you'll be amazed as you get sucked into it. And then you just feel like, I want to know what happens next. Mm. And I don't want to do something else because I feel like I'm going to miss something.
Yeah.
Because it really is. And it's strange to say that about a Christmas record, but it really, that's the feeling that you get in a really good way. It's like you just want to be involved in it.
Yeah, it's an immersive, it can be an immersive experience, I guess is how I'll say it. I was really trying to connect with it in the same way that John Denver did, not doing the exact same thing, but I really wanted to be genuine to his performances and the capacity and capability of his musicians. I felt that was respectful, that's what I wanted out of that. And I believe I achieved it because that album did actually, there was a lot of attention given to that album afterward that kind of brought me to some other places.
Yeah, this was 2009.
Yeah.
And this album came out and then some magic happened. Mm-hmm. And you connected with members of John Denver's band.
Yeah.
How'd that happen?
Well, okay. So imagine it being 2009. The album itself, although it was released, you know, I think in October, November of that year, I don't remember. But during the summertime, I came into contact with the woman that was running the Windstar organization. And for those of the listeners that don't know what that was at the time, Windstar was an environmental protection kind of agency, not agency, but an organization that John Denver created back in the 70s. And its purpose, frankly, was to preserve, you know, the environment, to preserve wildlife, whatever could be done to spearhead this important cause, which, as most people know, was equally important, maybe even more important to John Denver than his music. So I came into contact with her and we just got to talking about a few things. And she knew that I had put this album out and she asked if she could hear it. So I sent her some tracks and she heard it and she loved it. And apparently she introduced this to John Denver's brother, Ron Dutchendorf is his name. And suddenly I suddenly get a phone call from John Denver's brother. I didn't know it was coming. It just, because, you know, kind of actually it was on an answering machine. And at first I thought, okay, this someone else with the same name out there. I don't know. I'm here in Connecticut. That just doesn't happen over here. So I call him back. And he's like, he says, I was informed, you know, by the head of Windstar that you have this Rocky Mountain Christmas tribute. He said, I heard it. He said, I love it. He said, I think it's great. And he said, you know, what we'd really like to do, being that you're just about to release this, he said, we'd like to fly you out here coming up in October of this year, which, because every year in October, they would do a tribute to John Denver, basically for a full weekend on the weekend that he kind of passed away. So it's a commemorative thing. And they would do shows and different tribute shows with a lot of his bandmates that were out there, a lot of people that worked with him over the years. So basically they asked me to come out. They flew me out and bring some albums with you. We're going to promote it for you. We'd like you to play, you know, with some of his band members, maybe do some tribute shows, things like that. And that's what happened. And I thought to myself, I'm not going to say no to that. And so I did it. And that became actually the next 2 years after that as well. So 2009, 10, and 11, the thing just kept on building. And every year it became bigger and bigger. And I was out there every year and I was able to play with John Denver's band. And it was probably one of the most prominent experiences that I've had in music in general. It was just awesome. Plus to do it in Aspen of all places. That place, yeah. If you've never been there before, I don't know if you've been there before, but it's a magical place. So it was cool.
And it's a place that John Denver really loved.
Yeah, he did. He really did. And the first time I visited there was actually 98, but first time I saw it, I understood why right away. I thought, okay, yeah, I can see why you love it. Not to mention the fact, the views, obviously, the beauty of the environment, the beauty of the mountains, everything that's around you, but you're also secluded. You're in this valley and you're away from, everything. So if you leave Aspen, if you say to yourself, okay, I'm not going to go to the grocery store in Aspen, I'm going to go in whatever the next town is, you're driving quite a ways to get to that next town, And so it's an awesome place. So that John Denver loved it. I love it. And the irony is every year, I don't think it's quite as popular today as it was back then. But back then, I can tell you that, literally thousands of people would fly out there every year for this long John Denver weekend. And there were all these different events going on. And I was able to be a part of a lot of that stuff. And I met a lot of people. I met a lot of people a lot of other musicians and people that I am still in contact with today. Some musicians that he played with that I still work with today. In fact, there's a couple of his bandmates that are on the new album that I just did. So, the whole thing snowballed into something great.
And now fast forward to this year. And So we're 10 or so years later. And there's a new Christmas album.
Yeah.
Twilight, The Magic of Christmas. And one of the things I noticed right off the bat on this one is that, unlike your previous ones, You actually sing on some of these tracks.
Yeah, I do. I mean, there are a number of differentials on this record compared with the other ones, but it might be worth kind of just backtracking a little bit to even state why this album came out now when it's happening, or at this time. It's because it's not like if I go back 4 or 5 years ago, I don't think I had planned on doing another Christmas record at all. But when COVID hit back in 2020, and a lot of us ended up obviously being home from work or working from home, or hopefully still employed if you're okay. I was still employed, but as a teacher, we were home from basically middle of March all the way through the end of the school year. And what ended up happening was during this time, I ended up getting a phone call from the CEO at Attack Records, which is now Attack Media Group. They're a different name now, but he called me up and he said, I'm just wondering. He said, what are you doing right now? Are you recording anything? Are you where? I said, actually, no. I said, I haven't done a recording or created a recording since 2009. I mean, I have, but not for the purpose of releasing anything. It's really just been me doing things on the side for fun, or if I have a project, or maybe, if ESPN needs some music, I can provide that, but not for commercial release. So anyway, he said, I'm asking because he said, we've had to shelve everything we're going to release because of COVID. He said, everything's on the shelf. We can't release anything. Groups can't tour. Nothing's happening. He said, we're even losing movie contracts. And I said, whoa. I said, that's not good. He said, however, he said, that opens up an opportunity. He said, we can jump into the Christmas market, he said, right now, because that's a market that is going to thrive as a result of the whole COVID thing coming up, in the next few years. And he said, would you be interested in recording another album for us and sign another deal? And I said, well, I said, I'm interested. I said, but I need to give some thought into, what I want to do, because I don't want it to be the same thing I've already done. I really need to, stretch myself out into different places I haven't been yet. Not to mention the fact I'm not the same musician now that I was back in 2008 or 9. You definitely learn, sure, and you grow and you evolve. So anyway, he agreed to that. And he said, tell you what, he said, why don't you put together a list of songs that you think you might want to do, send them my way, and we'll talk about it. So I did. So I sent him a whole bunch of songs. It wasn't 18 songs at that point. It was probably 12, because I didn't really have a plan in terms of how many. And he looked at them, and then we talked, and he asked me why I wanted to do certain songs over others. And I told him, I explained it. And thankfully, they agreed to everything that I had suggested. But me doing the vocals, to come back to that, that wasn't actually planned when I jumped into recording the record. My original intent was to have certain songs that were going to be vocal orientation, and a bunch of others that were going to be instrumental. But as I entered the process, I started taking it one song at a time, recording tracks here and there, and I would come across a song that, you know, that needed a vocalist. And if I felt I was suitable for it, depending upon what the song was going to sound like, I'd give it a try. What really clinched it was when I recorded the Snow Miser, Heat Miser song. That one has a really, you know, it has a comical vibe to it. It's a fun tune, yeah. You know, and I've always loved that, The Year Without a Santa Claus in the song. So I said, I'm going to do a version of that song. So I did. So once I finally ended up getting most of the tracks down and the song was kind of working, I thought, you know, I could hire my friend who's also on this record, you know, as a vocalist, or I can try to do it myself. So I said, you know what? I sing this in school all the time with the kids. They love it. I said, I know how to do the song. I said, I'm going to try it out. So I did. So I recorded the track and I thought, it works. So I like that. I said, it works really well for my vocal style and from the timbre of my voice, that kind of song just works. And so that kind of brought me to a place where I think I gained the confidence of realizing that I could. I mean, I knew I could sing, but I always did backgrounds. I never did lead. And I never really thought about the opportunity of even trying it. And so once I did that, I had the confidence of saying, okay, yeah, you know what? This works. I'm going to take it to another level. So over the course of this record, I just found different songs, you know, that I thought would work for me. And I would just basically, you know, I just take chances on things that I take risks that I hadn't taken before. Carol of the Bells, I mean, that's mostly all me singing on there, actually. But I was able to find ways to create a choir sound, you know what I mean, with the vocals, things like that. And then if you listen to Hark the Herald Angels Sing, that's me also. But again, it's a very haunting song. It's a very haunting version of the song. It's not a happy sounding song, you know, but I found a way to interject the vocals and it worked, you know. So all of a sudden, this album just brought me to a place, at least vocally, where I thought, all right, this is a whole new thing for me and it's working. And so that's why I did it. I think I sang on, I don't know, 1, 2, 3, 4 maybe songs total. And the rest are comprised of two other vocalists that you probably already heard. And then we have, I think, maybe 2 instrumental songs, maybe. And that's it. So different record for sure.
Well, it is. And because I've been connected to you for a while, it's also, as I look on your website, for anybody, by the way, is bobsroycemusic.com. And I'll put that link in the show notes for this episode so you can click over and check it out. But in the credits for this, I noticed another name that I had noticed on an earlier album, your daughter, Madison.
Yes. Yeah.
That you had done a song for her on your second or third album.
Yeah. Yes. It was the third one, A Christmas Melody. Yes.
And now she's singing backing vocals for you.
Yeah. Yeah. That was another goal of mine on this record, was to get both of my daughters involved in one way or the other. And Madison's my oldest daughter. She does like to sing and she's old enough now. I mean, she's 17 now, but at the time when she recorded the part, she was, you know, maybe 16 years old. And, but she, I knew that I felt that, you know, blending her with me, especially on certain backing vocals, Carol of the Bells is one of them. And then you've got, you know, the night Before Christmas, which you've got that kind of a chorusy kind of thing going on in a song at the end where you have a whole bunch of vocalists together. You know, I felt that the blend between her and I would at least, I didn't want it to be all me, you know. And so I brought her into it. She agreed to do it. She liked doing it. She enjoyed it, which was fun. And then she played a keyboard part in Emmanuel, God With Us. And my other daughter did that as well. So I just wanted to bring them into it, give them the experience so they could see what it's like to record on a record in a studio and just to kind of see the process a little bit and maybe understand it. And that was really it. So yeah, it was kind of cool.
I know they're both young, but did they have musical interests?
Well, you know,
you're going to try and discourage them from that.
Yeah, no, actually, I don't discourage them from any of these things, mainly because I majored in marketing actually when I was in college. I didn't major in entertainment or music or anything. And so, but I've always done it on the side. And because I had always done it on the side, it eventually became the real deal for me, you know, in my 30s, which I didn't expect, but it did. So you never know how things are going to transpire. My thought process is very simple. If you want to go into entertainment, great. Just have a backup plan, have something else going on, because you're going to need that to support your music career. But no, actually, to answer your question, neither one of them are really involved. They love music. Okay. I mean, they love music. Mm-hmm. Madison played a little bit of guitar several years ago, but not too much. And then our youngest daughter, Jordan, she played, well, a little bit of guitar along. And then she actually asked me recently to teach her again. She wants to learn guitar again. So it's funny because obviously they're not into the same kind of music I am. You got one loves 21 Pilots. The other one loves My Chemical Romance. So now I'm into those guys too, because, you know, my daughter, I'm going to these concerts and it's like, hey, check this out. These guys are pretty cool. kind of makes me feel like I'm a little bit younger again, which is great. But no, they're really not really involved with music directly. I mean, not much at all. They know what I do. I think they appreciate what I do, and they definitely, you know, they tell me they're proud of it, which is, you know, which I appreciate. And yeah, they're great kids, and but they're going down their paths, and it's all good, you know.
It must be really cool to have this new Christmas album out and that your kids are part of it. And yeah, also you've got people who worked with John Denver on it too.
Yeah, it is. I guess that's the epitome of this album and this time, is that, and which is another reason why I'm happy I did take this on with the record label, because I think I had stepped away from it for so long, at least the recording piece of putting out records and, you know, the marketing aspect of it, all that I kind of, it's not that I forgot about it, I just didn't consider it. And what I didn't realize is how much I've done since then, and even how much I've even improved as a musician, performer, player, songwriter, everything, the whole thing. I just didn't realize the impact everything I've done since then has had on where I am today. And that is what really spilled out into this record, is all of those things. And so what I did is I kind of drew from everything, all my experiences and everything I've done. You know, so for example, over the years, I mean, I don't just play guitar. There was a time when I played mainly just guitar and maybe bass and, you know, maybe mandolin. Now it's like, you know, guitar, bass, mandolin, classical guitar, you know, 12-string guitar. I mean, ukulele, you know, flute, clarinet, trumpet, you know, drums. I mean, percussion, all kinds of stuff, singing. And so that allowed me to kind of say, okay, I have all these other things I can do. So one of my goals ended up becoming to literally incorporate every single instrument I have somehow, some way into this record, every guitar I own, everything. And I did, I incorporated all that. And along the way, again, the experiences over the years I had with the John Denver band and those people, I brought them into it as well. I mean, there's, I think, four songs on this album where I needed an upright bass player. I play electric bass, but I don't have an upright fretless bass. And even if I did, I probably would be able to play it very well because it's fretless. So I thought of Alan Derrimo was his name. Alan Derrimo was John Denver's bass player back 80s into the 90s. And I played with him out in Aspen too. So I got to know him, and he's obviously a world-renowned bass player. The guy's incredible, and he has his own studio too. So I thought, you know what, I'm gonna contact him and see if he's into it. And he said, when I contacted him, he said, yeah, he said, I'd love to, that'd be great. He says, just, you know, send me the tracks. He said, I'll record them out here, send them back to you, and good to go. And sure enough, every song he did, he would put his bass track down, send it back out to me in a WAV file. I dump it into my Pro Tools system, into the session, and I didn't have to do much of anything. That's how good he is. The precision of his performance and the sound of his track, it was all there. So it's the experience was amazing. And he would do things in the songs that were just intricate that I know I couldn't have found anywhere else around here in other bass players. So that was great. He was awesome to work with. Another person is Molly Weaver. She's the female vocalist on this record, and she sings on, I think, four songs as well, like if memory serves. And she also performed with John Denver, although she's a lot younger than that generation. But she performed with John Denver because her family knew John Denver when they were younger. And so she used to hang out in John Denver's yard while her dad was doing business with John Denver. I don't know. It's some long story like that. And so she, So I met her in Aspen as well, because she would perform with them. And she's, you know, probably one of the best vocalists I've ever worked with in my life. She's just beyond talented. And I brought her the Amy Grant songs, because there's three Amy Grants. Well, there's four Amy Grant songs on here, but three of them I had her sing. And I knew she was the only person that was going to be able to pull that off, because the reality is Amy Grant is a force to be reckoned with. Yeah. In terms of her vocal capability, even just the sound of her voice. And Molly hit it. She nailed it. So that's another one. So there's two people on there that actually are from that whole John Denver experience and that worked with John Denver himself.
And I just think it's really kind of, I don't know, cool, I guess is the word I'll use. I think it's really kind of cool that you revisited Aspenglow again on this album, which a song that was on your first Christmas album and is a song most everybody associates with John Denver, and that Molly Weaver sings it on this.
Yeah, she does.
That's terrific.
It's cool. And the interesting thing with it, though, and the reason why I put it on is not because there's a reason why I actually put it on, and it really had nothing to do with wanting to redo the song. The original versions I did, like back on Hometown Christmas, and then the one that I ended up doing for Rocky Mountain Christmas Tribute, those were really more in line with John's original version in terms of how the performances were done on the guitars and the other instruments. That sort of, you know, equaled that. But when I met Molly out in Aspen back in 2009, we ended up exchanging email addresses. We got to know each other a little bit. She's in LA. She works out there. Well, she's a full-time musician, vocalist as well, out there. So we got to know each other, and we both wanted or decided we love John Denver's music so much, we wanted to create a John Denver tribute kind of thing at some point, which we did for a little while. And we started picking different songs from John Denver, but we wanted to create versions that were completely different from John Denver's version. I'm talking, put like a spin on it that you would never expect. And Aspenglow, it turned out to be one of the songs that we chose. So if you listen to that one, you'll notice that the guitar part is definitely performed differently. You'll notice that some of the tracking and different things that are in there are definitely different. You know, we added different things in terms of music that are not in John Denver's version, and maybe didn't do things that are in John Denver's version. And then even the vocals that she did, I mean, you'll notice her approach to it is not exactly like John Denver's. Certain melody lines are, others are not. And then she added in backing vocals that don't exist on John Denver. So it's its own version of this song. And that's why I put it on here. I felt that it was worthy of being released and being heard.
And one of the things that I really like about this new album is that, I mean, there's 18 tracks on it.
Yeah.
And it really captures, I don't know another way to say it, it really captures Christmas. You've got fun songs on here. You have the Snow Miser, Heat Miser song. You've got White Christmas. You have more sacred songs, Breath of Heaven, Coventry Carol,
right.
Hark the Herald Angels Sing. There's the cover of Aspenglow. There's Grown Up Christmas List. It really covers Christmas.
It's interesting you say that, because it's true, actually. And that was a goal. That was a definitive goal of mine. Is I did not want, and this is not to say that my other albums are like that, but my earlier albums, my first couple albums for sure, those two records definitely had a style that was, you know, pretty dominant across the board. You know, it wasn't, there was not a lot of diversity, not that there has to be, but there wasn't. And it definitely sort of collected what I was at the time in terms of what I was playing and my style at the time. In this case, I wanted to hit every area that I could. I wanted it to be a very diverse sounding record, so that if you start listening at the beginning, you don't necessarily know what's coming up next. And you don't know what's going to be happening in five tracks from now. And you certainly don't know what's going to be happening at the end. And so one of the things that I did is I made sure that my approach to each song was for the song and not for the purpose of the record. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but that was my mindset. And I wanted to also have songs that would sound more modern, and also that would have more of that 1940s, 1950s Bing Crosby thing going on, you know, that kind of, you know, brings you back there. And that's why even one of the catchphrases, I guess, for this new album release with the label is, you know, it says a little bit of old, a little bit of new, you know, the new RCA or Cherry Lane Music album released, you know, that kind of thing. You know, and it says it's a journey from 1950s to present day, which is really, I think, what it is. And that's what I was trying to capture. So the fact that you say that, because obviously you and I haven't talked about that yet, you say that, well, that tells me, I guess I got there.
Definitely. It starts with Melika Licky Maka and ends with Hark the Herald Angels Sing, and really there's just about everything you can imagine in between.
Yeah.
And it, like I said, it's 18 songs. And and Bob, I have to ask you, it's
please,
18 songs on this one. This is your fifth Christmas album.
Yeah.
And I feel a little silly for even saying this, but is there more Christmas music maybe in the pipeline?
That's a good question. So In 2009, I said no. And I think I stuck to my no until 2020 when Attack Records called me. And then as I got into this record, it became obviously a big yes. And I started to become just really immersed in it. And I was excited about it just because I could see that this thing was going to go to a place I had never been before. And so suddenly I had this whole, I feel like I've elevated things to a level I've never been with this record. And so my point is that I'm not going to say no to that. Will there be a new Christmas album over the next 2 years? More than likely not. But I have plans to do some other recordings at some point of some Christmas music, maybe not necessarily for the purpose of a full-length record like this, but I do have things in my mind. But I am going to be doing an all-original record. Probably I may start next year. It's going to be pretty much all instrumental going through the whole record, and it's going to be, if everything goes as planned, it'll be something that's sort of attached to seasons and nature and, you know, sort of the cyclical years it runs through. And so that'll be something that comes first. But I don't want to say no, because I said no before and I came back and did this, and I probably will end up doing something again. Probably.
I had mentioned your website before, bobsirois.com, and Sirois is Sirois. Is that the best place for people to kind of keep up with what you're doing?
Yeah, it really is. And the reason being is that it's attached to everything out there. I mean, you know, so like, for example, if you want to get to, I'm on the site right now, I'm just kind of looking at it so I can remember what's on there. I mean, all of the different digital music platforms are reachable from there. So, you know, I mean, there's going to be some YouTube videos coming out pretty soon, because the label's doing three videos, two of which have already been released. They did a video for Melakaliki Maka, which was released a little over a week ago. Then the Christmas song was released yesterday on video. And then I believe Carol of the Bells is going to be the next one they're going to release in a week, maybe a week and a half. So the videos are going on the website. You know, obviously this podcast will probably make it there at some point. Everything is accessible from there. So yes, to answer your question, I would say that's probably the place to go.
Okay. As I've mentioned before, I'll put a link to that in the show notes below, and
great,
a link to your YouTube channel so people can check that out. And what I always tell people with YouTube is that when you get there to the artist page, subscribe. And that way YouTube will let you know when these next videos are up.
Yeah, it is.
Going back and checking, you'll get a notification. And yeah, and it's not like Bob is putting out a million videos every day so that it will be annoying to you. You
know, right.
It'll be so, but you'll want to see the next one. So do that. And then you don't have to try and remember what day it's coming out or keep going back to it.
So I have to ask you a question, though, Ken, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So because you kind of mentioned to me earlier some of the songs that are some of your favorites on some of the prior albums, and especially Christmas Melody, what sort of attracted you to that record. So on this new record, what's the standout track that really grabs your attention?
That's hard. Let me see.
I know. I know I was going to make it tough on you on this one.
The standout.
If there's more than one, great. I just figured I'd ask. I'm curious.
Well, you know, it's, and I'm not trying to, I would probably say the Snow Miser, Heat Miser, because that's unexpected and it's fun.
Yeah, I know.
So that would probably be that for me. But there's so much, it's hard for me to be completely objective about it because I've known you for so long.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of what went into this, because when I saw this, I thought Aspen Glow again. And then I saw that Molly Weaver sings it. And I thought, okay, that's really kind of neat that it's, you know, it's a full circle sort of record. And then I saw that your kids are on it too.
Yeah.
So that was, it's, you know, it's hard to just look at it and go, well, this is the standout.
Yeah.
But when I, you know, my initial thing when I was first listening to it, and I saw that the Snow Miser, Heat Miser song was on there, and that's so different from anything that you've done before.
It is, yeah, that's for sure.
I thought, you know, it would be, the only thing that could have competed with that was if you recorded You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch.
Yeah, that's another one. I've actually considered that one, although that one scares me a little bit. So because there's... That's not just, hey, let's play the song and with a bunch of chords and let's get the vocal on there. That's gotta, you gotta capture all the other melodies going on there. And you really need to do it in a way that makes sense. Otherwise, that's a song you can really crush if you're not careful. I've considered it. In fact, funny, the eighth grade class at my school where I teach, one of the girls in that class asked me, I think a month ago, because we have a Christmas concert next week with them. And she goes, you know, Mr. Stroyce, can we do the Grinch this year? And I said, ooh, geez. I said, okay. I said, let me go home. And her name was Natalia. I said, let me go home and check that out. I'm going to take a look at it again. I'll let you know. So I actually ultimately came back in and said, I don't think it's going to work. And I told her the reason why is that it's just me playing guitar and you guys are singing. But I can't capture all of these other melodies that are so important in that song that if you don't hear them, you lose the song. And she understood, and I kind of explained it to her, showed it to her. So that's what I mean. That's a pretty wild tune. People think it's a simple song. It is not simple at all.
That's the magic of a song like that, it sounds like a simple song, but it's not.
It's awesome. It's really what they did at the time is quite outstanding.
But getting back to Twilight, when I saw Snow Miser, Heat Miser on there, I was really surprised, and I had to skip ahead to hear that.
Yeah.
I had just started listening, and I had listened to Melikaliki Maka, and I was probably halfway through the Christmas song, and I'm scanning down while I'm listening, and I saw, wait a minute. Snow Miser, Heat Miser. Let me skip down. I need to hear that.
Yeah, I had a feeling most people would probably, and I've heard that from other people already as well, where they say, wow, that's, I hadn't heard that song. I mean, they've heard it, but I haven't heard a new version of it really for the most part ever. And, but that's why I did it, because I love the song that much and the program. I still watch that program every year. I mean, how can you not? It's just those are classics. And that was a fun song to do, you know, and I'm happy that I did it. And I'm also happy that I sang on it as well, just because that, as I mentioned earlier, that brought me to a place where I did a lot of other vocals on this record that I really didn't think I could achieve. And I did. So that was a nice thing. I didn't just accomplish a record. What I did here is I advanced myself as a musician into places I'd never been. And I'm happy that I did it because it opens up a lot of other opportunities, like anything in life.
I was very happy to come across this and see that there was a new release. And I'll keep my fingers crossed, even though this is your fifth Christmas album and there's been so much done already. But I'll keep my fingers crossed for maybe some more Christmas music in a couple of years.
Something will come down the pike at some time, I'm sure. Just don't know exactly when. It's also worth mentioning, though, that the first track, Melikaliki Maka, that actually just got picked up for a movie that's going to be released next year. This movie is called The Sacrifice Game. So it's an insertion. The record company is in the process of licensing it now. And that's going to be in a movie that comes out sometime in 2023.
Nice.
Yeah. So very good thing.
Well, Bob, it's been so much fun catching up and talking about lots of Christmas music with you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being part of this today.
No, I appreciate it very much, Ken, and I appreciate all the time. It's been great, and have a great holiday season with your family. I hope it's a wonderful one. I hope you have a great new year and enjoy the time.
Thanks. I hope you do, too. And thank you so much for listening and for continuing to support the Sounds of Christmas station and podcast. Anytime you're ready for Christmas music, we're ready for you. Just go to soundsofchristmas.com and click on the tree or the player on the front page or on the Listen Now page. You can also grab our app in the Google Play Store and take the music with you wherever you go. And as far as this podcast goes, we're now on lots of podcasting sites. So if you didn't find us on your favorite today, just search for the Sounds of Christmas next time you go there, and I'm pretty sure you'll see our tree. Then you can subscribe, and you'll never miss another episode. If you have comments or suggestions on this episode, previous episodes, or the Sounds of Christmas station, feel free to reach out to me on social media or through the website. Thanks again, and may you always believe in Santa Claus.